provides a provision for a candidate.
Good days.
I'm Chip.
And I'm Nicole.
Together we host the Mind Cemetery, where the paranoia about the paranormal comes to rest.
We broadcast live every Monday night at 11 p.m. Eastern for 2 full hours. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook, as well as our website, mindcemetery.com.
We cover all the topics you won't hear on your local news.
Well, I don't really like watching the news anyway.
Then this is the perfect show for someone like you.
I wouldn't go that far. After all, I am the skeptic.
So you don't believe in ghosts?
Nope.
UFOs?
Yeah, no.
How about Bigfoot?
Not really. You'll never find a Bigfoot.
How about the lost city of Atlantis, then?
Isn't that on Google Earth? No? Then forget it. It's never going to get found.
Looks like I have my work.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montel, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Your night with the Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Online available for free. I can send you the link after the show if you want.
Okay, well, hang on, because we are now live. Welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shade, folks. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and today is March 6, 2012. For tonight's program, just like all programs, I would love to have the audience's input with questions and comments. So if you join the virtual auditorium in Pal Talk, you can send them to me via text. And if you're listening through one of the other venues, you can email them to me at gscott@exogenynetwork.com. Our guests also have pages on our website. Just click on their names in the left-hand column, which they're sorted out by alphabet. And you can go straight to their page. Our listeners can also find our guest list there, so you know who was on which show. Lots of other great information is also found there, as well as links to blogs, Facebook, Twitter, and Plus. And for all of our fans that are also foodies, we've got a really fun project coming up as we put together a cookbook. So be sure to go to the website and find out how to submit a recipe yourself. We're also going to be holding a drawing during our anniversary show at the end of this month, so get those recipes in. Each submission is worth an entry. We haven't decided yet what we're going to offer as a prize, but I'll guarantee you one thing. It's not going to be anything big enough that you need to worry about paying taxes on it. So It should still be something that anyone who cooks or eats will absolutely love. Now, tonight's guest is a very fascinating couple. I would like to introduce Tara Allen and Tyler Kellen by making them introduce themselves, and that's a lot of fun. Tara, since it's ladies first, you get to start.
All right, thank you. Like you said, my name is Tara. I'm from the Midwest, and I am a writer and a photographer. I guess you can call me an adventurer with my husband. We basically do a lot of fun projects together, and we put it all together on our website, which is www.goingslowly.com. I'm currently, my latest project is I'm currently working on a cookbook for bicycle tourists. So it's very specific recipes that people who are interested in bicycling and camping can make while on the road. So that's what I'm up to in a nutshell right now.
That sounds fascinating. Tyler, you're next in the hot seat. Would you be so kind as to introduce yourself to the audience, too?
Sure, Gia. My name's Tyler Elso. I'm the other half of GoingSlowly.com. I'm a software developer. I wrote our website and our journal, and right now I'm working on putting together a software program for managing databases for the public transit and insurance industries. So
you already have one, but you're revamping it.
Okay. That sounds like a very complicated project. I know that just dealing with the website that we have, I can get very frustrated. Today I was banging my head on the desk wanting to cry because it didn't want to let me do pictures. Uh-huh. And I finally got it done. Convinced that, okay, I really was what I was, or whatever it needed. I don't know, a handshake, I don't know. Sweet, kind, and considerate words, something. Now, you know, a lot of people might be wondering how on earth I found Tara and Tyler, and I actually found him on the internet. Tyler asked me, just as we were coming onto the air, how I'd originally found their blog and journal and website and all that. And considering that they were bicycle touring the world, the way I found them might be kind of odd. I was actually doing a Google search for folding portable camp oven. And lo and behold, their website came up. And I'm not as big a cyclist as these two are, obviously. Very few people can say they spent 2 years touring the world on a bicycle. But I do like bicycling, and I love camping, and I can get Tara's whole cooking thing because I'm usually the duly elected camp cook in group campouts. So their journal turned out to be very, very interesting. How did you guys decide to tour? I mean, Tara, I know from reading your journal, you were not an avid bicyclist when this project sort of was born, and not really an adventurer either.
No, not even a little bit. Well, okay, maybe a little bit. I love to travel, but never anything like this. I'd lived abroad before, but I'd never done much with bicycles. I'd been camping maybe about 5 times in my life. The longest I'd ever ridden a bicycle was to work and back, about a mile. And it just wasn't my thing. And I started dating Tyler long distance from, I was in Illinois and he was in Minnesota. And I was at the movies with the girlfriend and I got a text message from him and said, would you like to sell everything you own and go biking around Africa with me indefinitely? And I guess I was used to, I don't know, I have a lot of friends who have a lot of ideas. And we would generate lots of ideas and get really excited about them, but we wouldn't actually do them. So part of me was like, oh, yeah, sure. That sounds great. It sounds like fun. Why not? I didn't actually expect that it would happen. And then I found out he was completely serious. And then I did some pretty heavy backpedaling, and it kind of went from there, determining, okay, well, no, maybe not Africa, but maybe Southeast Asia or maybe France. I like France. So, and then it kind of stemmed from a month of travel to a year of travel And then eventually blossomed from there into 2 years of travel. So it happened pretty organically.
Tyler, you know, it sounds like you were kind of the instigator in this. What was your inspiration for this whole idea?
Ever since I was a little kid, I've wanted to travel the world, and I always had this idea that someday I was going to get rich, and then I was going to travel the world. And so from about 18 to 23 or so, I would save all year long every year, not take any vacations, and I would take off for 1 month and do a motorcycle tour. I was really big into motorcycles, so I did a tour of the West Coast for a month. I did a tour of the East Coast for a month. I rode my motorcycle up to Alaska. And after I'd started all of North America, I started looking abroad, thinking, okay, how am I going to get myself and my motorcycle, you know, somewhere else? And it realized that getting a motorcycle overseas was going to be really expensive and really time-consuming. And so, obviously, if I was going to go, I would need it for it to be longer. And so, anyway, I had this idea that I wanted to do this thing. And I just thought that, you know, someday I'm going to get rich and it's going to work out. And just realized I wasn't actually getting rich and that I didn't need to be rich to go do it. I was watching a documentary by Charlie Borman and Ewan McGregor called Long Way Round, wherein they ride motorcycles from London all the way across Russia up to near the Bering Strait. They fly to Alaska and ride all the way to New York, so basically around the world as well as you can on a motorcycle anyway. And they had a second documentary called Long Way Down where they did the same thing from the north of Scotland to the southern tip of Africa. And I was watching this documentary wishing that I was them. And they met a guy in Africa on a bicycle. And he had like 20 gallons of water strapped to his bicycle. And that was it. He was alone in the desert and they rode by him on their motorcycle and they stopped to talk to him. And just like a bell went on, a light bulb came on. And I was like, oh, you can do it on a bicycle because then you wouldn't have to worry about, you know, repairs and gasoline, and it'd be really easy, and we could totally do it. And so it was really a whim that I sent the text message. And then Tara said yes, and I sort of wheedled my way through there just little by little until we wound up with what we wound up doing. So that's where it came
from. In all the process of getting ready to do this tour, what was the hardest step?
I think probably just actually deciding to do it. And accepting the fact that it's going to require selling everything you own and leaving your job and leaving your friends and leaving your family and just to actually make the commitment to actually do it. And once you've decided that you really are going to do it and you mean it and you're committed to it, then everything kind of falls into place after that. It's hard, but you make a list of goals and you know, start tackling them one by one. But actually saying, okay, we're really going to do this and setting a date is probably the hardest part.
Setting a date and buying the plane tickets.
That was a big one for you?
Yeah.
I went back through some of your journal today, you know, when I was getting ready for you and everything. And, you know, I read about the difficulties you had with the airplane tickets initially to get yourselves to Scotland and everything. Were you on second thoughts at that particular moment, you know, as you're standing there arguing with Expedia and trying to deal with the ticket situation?
I don't remember having second thoughts about the trip, but I remember feeling like I wasn't mentally prepared for this level of difficulty, but I knew that, like, all we really had to do was just, we were going to get there eventually, and our bicycles were going to get there eventually, no matter what it, you know, no matter what it took. So I don't think we were regretting it then.
I don't remember being too worried about it.
It was a huge hassle.
Hey, a lot of people would say, oh, my God, you know, this trip's starting off awful. How much worse can it get? You know, and I was thinking about, okay, you know, I've done some things that a lot of people thought were kind of goofy. In hindsight, maybe they were kind of goofy. You know, a couple of wives. I'm considering, you know, I've got a daughter, you guys' age. So, you know, I've been down a few more circles around the sun than you. And I'm thinking, you know, taking a trip abroad is a big deal for most people. But taking it abroad and then having to start your tour by assembling your bicycles in an airport and then packing them up with everything you essentially own anymore has to be kind of a moment of truth.
I would say that's totally accurate. Yeah. I remember that we spent you know, almost 2 years planning for the trip, and during that time, we would tell people all the time what we were doing. We're like, yeah, we're going to ride bicycles from Scotland to Bangkok. We're going to do it in a year, and we're going to camp along the way, and just how easily it sort of tripped off the tongue that we would say it.
It just sounded good, and yeah, it sounded right. It sounded easy. We've done all kinds of research and read blogs, and we thought we were so prepared. And
we arrived in Scotland, and we were putting our bikes together, and it did just seem completely and wholly absurd. It was like, well, I guess we're here, and we're going to ride our bike country now. So
yeah.
Teetering away from the airport on our bikes was actually the first time we rode them completely loaded with all of our gear. It just felt wholly and completely ridiculous, but
yeah.
It was also really exciting.
I remember, for me, it wasn't so much putting the bikes together, because that was Tyler's area, and I wasn't even involved at all. I just left it to him, trusted that he knew what he was doing. But the teetering away from the airport was a really big deal for me, and I had lots of second thoughts then. What have I just gotten myself into? What am I doing? I can't even ride this bicycle. All kinds of second thoughts. But I think the important thing, I mean, in the back of my mind, I knew, obviously, it was going to be a lot harder than I thought it was going to be. But you just have to sort of say yes and do it and put yourself in a position where you can't really go back very easily. At that point, it was a lot easier to teeter along into Scotland on a bicycle than it was to try to go home. So
Yeah. Now, in your journeys, okay, now, where I kind of have a heads up on most of the audience, because I've been reading a long time, and I saw the evolution in what your website even looked like, from what it started when I first was reading it to the very polished thing that it is now. Now, the journal entries are the same, but you know, well, maybe you've gone back and edited some, but essentially what they say is the same thing. But I'd seen an incredible evolution in you two as people, as writers, as photographers, you know, just evolving along your journey. What was probably what you feel like you learned the most during this entire experience?
For me, I think it was what I really require to be happy and to survive. And it turns out that's quite a lot less than what is commonly accepted in our society. I need a place to sleep. I need Tara. I need some food. And that's about it. It was really, really... And a project. I have a project, too. It was really incredible to just let go of everything and travel lightly and to really experience, you know, maybe there was a sense of came from knowing, you know, we were going to go back home, but just, I don't know, not having any possessions and being able to just go and do and as you please, when you please, was really, really a moving experience and really changed the way I view the world.
Yeah. I think for me, probably the greatest lesson is just how much we are capable of, how far we can push ourselves, and how much we can grow as people. I almost hesitate to call it a lesson because I feel like I'm a completely different person than I was before. I think the trip changed me in such a massive, massive way that it wasn't like I learned some lesson. It was like I was changed and ground down so much like in a rock tumbler and became a completely different person. So,
uh-huh. So what kind of changes did you see in yourself?
I'm much more capable now of handling stress, traveling, catastrophes, anything really. Much more relaxed, much more capable. I get a lot done now. I'm really focused, and I was not before at all. I lived in an apartment and was totally messy and had dirty dishes all over the place, and I was not focused at all. And now I feel like just the discipline of doing the same thing over and over every day, even though it's hard and even though you don't want to, just it changed me, and I hold that discipline to this day. So I think that's probably the biggest one. I think I'm definitely more.
Well, you know, I think those kind of changes are inevitable if we're going to grow as people, too.
Yeah.
All of us need to find a way to sort of provide the catalyst for us to continue developing. Now, you know, when you started on this journey, what kind of ideas did you have in mind as far as what you thought was going to happen?
Well, I should say another lesson that I learned on the trip was learning to slow down, which is a huge lesson that I don't think I would have learned any other way. And so my idea of what the trip was going to be was, like, really structured before we left. Like, before we had a, you know, Excel spreadsheet that said we were going to be in this country for this many days, and we were going to ride X amount of miles a day, and we were going to get from here to here, and we were going to go from there to there, and everything was, like, pretty well planned out. And I don't think it was more than a week before we realized that, like, the plan was not even remotely going to work, and that you just had to let go of the plan. And so, yeah, our picture of what the trip was going to look like was absolutely, I think, nothing like what it actually wound up being at all. I say that in the best possible way because it was amazing.
Yeah. I also, in my mind, I never anticipated the photography or the writing being a huge part of our journey, but it was. It absolutely was. And in a lot of ways, it shaped our journey. Because we wrote every single day of the trip, and we took photos every single day of the trip. And I think that, you know, besides having the actual physical bicycle tour molding us and shaping us, we had these other outlets, these other creative outlets to grow and improve upon. And so we, you know, took it upon ourselves to improve as writers, to improve as photographers. And that's definitely something I did not anticipate at all.
We didn't plan to journal every day of the trip at any point, did we? No, that was not part of the plan. It was mm-hmm. just the first few weeks, so much was happening that we just wanted to get it all down and record it. And then after a few weeks, we had, you know, this backlog, like, well, we've been doing it for a month, we can't stop now, and it just never ended.
Well, I have to admit, you know, I've read other bicycling touring blogs since then, and they're not as well done as yours. Reading yours, to me, it was just more than a touring journal or bicycling journal. I mean, if you're not an avid cyclist, then reading a bicycle journal is kind of like, ugh. Mm-hmm. A lot of these touring cyclists, you know, do 75 to 150 miles a day. They're religious about it, but they don't seem to experience the same way.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
It's about the miles. It's not about the journey.
I think, first of all, thank you. That's really sweet of you. Thank you for liking our website. But I completely agree with you. I actually, most of the blogs that I read are cooking blogs and some homesteading blogs, but I really don't read very many bicycle blogs or travel blogs unless I know the people. It's not something that interests me. I still don't get totally psyched up about miles or feats of strength or anything like that. So I can completely understand that.
Well, I'll admit, I have a cycling blog. Mine is called Cycle As Is because I'm past the point of spandex, okay? Spandex is not going to work for me. There's something that should not be seen in public with me and spandex. I don't want a road bike. I have some physical disabilities. Riding in a hunched over position is, like, not happening. Mm-hmm. You know, it's physically impossible for me. Worrying about miles? No. I worry about getting to where I'm going and then getting back home. That's my goal. Oh, and there's thousands and thousands of cyclists in the United States that are like me. Now, I've gone into many bike shops, and I've had some really negative experiences because some of them do cater to what I call the spandex crowd. Okay, they don't want to deal with older adults who are obviously not spending their lifetime planted on the saddle of their bike.
Or even completely inexperienced people who want to bike around the world like I was.
Now, I happen to be really fortunate. I've got a bike shop that works with me. I mean, they answer my questions, they help me. I happen to be working on a motorized bicycle project, mostly because I want to make sure I can always get home. And they've been really helpful with that, even though they don't deal with motors. But as far as the peculiarities of the bike, whole bike things, this project's been going on for months. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a whole different thing when you're not worried about the miles. My thing is, it's about the journey. I don't care how fast it happens. You know, if it takes me 4 hours instead of 4 minutes, I don't care. You know, and so I can appreciate the way you guys slow down, even though you're at a much different life stage. Me going up a mountain pass in Switzerland, no. Give me about 2 weeks on foot because I'd have to push the bike. you know, it's not happening, you know. So for me, the cycling is more about having fun because I've discovered that cycling, like I used to ride horses. When you ride horses, you see the world from a different way. It's a slower pace. When you see it in a car, it's whizzing past you. You're insulated from it. You're closed off from it in this cabin. And, you know, it was neat to watch somebody else see the world in a way that I enjoy seeing it. I like slowing down. There's a reason why I used to drive a Jeep. You could take the top off and create a better connection with what you were going through rather than being completely shut off from it. Yeah. So it's, you know, I like seeing how, you know, the little things about stopping and getting boiled eggs, some funny-looking tomatoes, or whatever, because it made the story that much more personal. So in all the journeying that you guys did, you know, can you think of something really funny that really, you know, even now when you think about it, it kind of makes you laugh?
Yeah. I can think of two offhand. One of them's in our journal, one of them's not in our journal. The first one that's in our journal is we were cycling along a canal in France, and Tyler stopped to try to bend down and tie his shoe. And he was holding with one hand onto his big, heavy touring bicycle, and with the other hand trying to bend down and tie his shoe and somehow balance the bicycle on his hip or somehow basically prevent the bicycle from falling over. And he couldn't do it, and it was so frustrating to him because the front was so heavy that it would whip around and go to one side, and then the whole bike would start twirling. And he freaked out because it was so frustrating, and it was one of those "what are we doing" moments. Ridiculous! I hate this. I can't even tie my stupid shoe. And he took his He, what were you doing? You
kicked a rock because I was upset about it.
Yeah, he started kicking a rock because he was so upset, and his shoe flew off because it wasn't tied, and it flew into the canal and started floating away down the canal. And then I just started laughing, and he jumped in the water through a wall of nettles and rescued his shoe and then came out all bedraggled and tried to put his shoe on. So anyway, that's one of my favorite funny memories. So.
And your other one that you didn't put in your journal?
Oh, the other one. We were in Italy. We were free camped by the side of the road in Italy. And we had been talking because Tyler had this guy that he knew whose parents had a house in Naples. And we were really getting close to Naples. And we were excited and we were going to try to call them on Skype and see if we could meet them and maybe hopefully stay at their house and take a couple days and see the city. So Tyler calls up his friend and is like, "Oh yeah, so we're getting really close to Naples." And the guy tells him that his parents have a house in Naples, Florida. And I start busting up laughing because it's one of those destinations. Like, I know people who have gone to Naples, Florida for vacation. It's just one of those places that you go. And he had no idea, and I was just completely assuming, as was he, that these people had a house in Naples, Italy, so that was funny.
Yeah, that would be funny. How about you, Tyler? Does anything make you laugh?
Hmm. We were free camping somewhere in Italy off the side of the road again. And at the beginning of the trip, Tara was really concerned about getting caught, about when we would camp for free that we would get caught and somehow like someone was going to show up with a shotgun and be like, get off my land, or a police officer was going to find us and we were going to get in trouble. And this particular night, we had had a really hard time finding a place to set up, and so we set up in kind of a really crappy area. It was by a fence by a factory. And so we set up the tent, and we set up our cook stove, and we were making dinner, and no one seemed to be around. And then this security guard shows up, and Tara was just like, looked like she was a deer in headlights, just totally terrified that this guy was going to be, you know, really upset, and oh man, we're in real trouble now. And he just wanted to come over to offer us coffee. And I just thought that was really funny and really, really cool. And I think from then on, pretty much our concerns about getting caught when we free camped had sort of fallen away.
Mm-hmm. I have to admit that free camping, or what a lot of people refer to as stealth camping, was something that we did a lot of when I lived in Arizona. And we would travel and camp often. And one particular trip, the night before, we'd had an incident with a individual that was heavily under the influence of something. And so I was a little bit paranoid. I didn't want any people around to bother us, you know. And so this picky rejection of sites had gone on and on until finally it's like the middle of the night. It's really late. We're really tired. And I finally agreed to a spot. Now, we're just camping with bedrolls beside the Jeep. When we wake up the next morning, the spot that I had finally agreed to be an abandoned dump, literally an abandoned dump. The debris, you couldn't see it in the headlights. We didn't drive around this entire area, but yeah, I had finally agreed to camp in a dump. And yeah, rats and all.
Yeah.
So that'd have to be probably my favorite free camp memory, is finally consenting, and it was a dump.
Nice.
It's like that last motel, you know, when you finally give in and it turns out that it's a dump too. Yeah. We've all had those. Now, in all the traveling, you know, I know that on occasion you guys did stay in hotels, motels, et cetera, on your journey too. And while finding a nice hotel can be somewhat easy in most places, the bad ones usually make for better stories. So what was the worst one that has the best story?
Oh, man. I don't think that our worst experience is necessarily the place that made it awful. But I'm thinking about the weather, the one where it was like a million degrees and we just laid around naked in the room with the fan on.
Oh, no. I think
we were going to die.
No. Well, there's two. There are some pretty grody ones in Tunisia that we stayed in. But there's no fun story surrounding those. But there was one that we stayed in Thailand. There's another one, actually. Anyway, there's one that we stayed in Thailand in this national park, and it was super overpriced, and it was really pretty gross. And the worst part was there were leeches everywhere. And this national park just was crawling, literally crawling with leeches that were inching along like inchworms, and they would drop from the trees, and if you walked anywhere, you would get them on your feet. It was horrible, and they were in this hotel room, and it was not fun. And that was probably my worst hotel experience.
I would say leeches rank as among the creepiest of the creepy crawly things.
God, I had a nightmare about them just the other week. It was terrible. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's mine. Uh-huh. The other one was the brothel.
The brothel. We once stayed at a brothel that we didn't realize was a brothel. It seemed nicer than all the crappy places that we had looked at. And when we got into the room and we were getting set up, we flipped on the light and we're looking at the bed and we're like, that's strange. What do you suppose that is? And there was a mirror going along the length of the bed, just about an inch above the bed along the wall. And we couldn't figure out for the longest time, like, what this mirror could possibly be
that
for. Okay, yeah.
Like,
oh, my God. We just...
Yeah.
Do a brothel.
And there was a red light and everything.
Oh, yeah, it had a red light. I forgot about that.
Yeah, they do make for good stories, though, right?
Yeah. Those are the kinds of beds where, well, that's the kind of hotel where I'd much rather be camping in my own sleeping bag and not in anyone else's sheets.
Yeah, I have to admit, there have been some places I've stayed in over the years where I actually brought my camping gear in and I slept in my sleeping bag instead of the bed. I was more interested in probably the air conditioning or the shower than I was the bed, something like that. I have to admit that sometimes the heat can start to get to a person. So, all the journeys, we not only all sleep, but we also all eat. And whereas most people, when they're traveling on a journey like that, are meals in restaurants, and may not experience anything more authentic for the region than McDonald's is to American cuisine, I know you guys did a lot of your own cooking, which meant you shopped in local markets. What were some of the strange things that you saw there that kind of shocked your American sensibilities, at least initially?
The thing that strikes me, well, first of all, I love markets. Going to markets is probably one of my very favorite things about traveling. I love the foods of other cultures. I love the markets of other cultures. I just love getting in there and talking to the people that work there. I guess for me, some of the more interesting, shocking things found at markets. Vietnam, there was a dog, like a skinned dog, for sale with a long tail. There are always sometimes rats scurrying around. The fish markets are always really interesting because there's big, huge buckets of, like, living creatures, like, riding vats of eels and, like, big buckets of squids and all kinds of things like that. There's also usually blood dripping off the tables at the meat markets and big cow heads hanging and all kinds of gruesome things. But
how about you, Tyler? I know you're not the same kind of foodie that Tara is, but still the markets had to be a different experience for you as well.
I thought that they were, when we left on the trip, I didn't even like vegetables, so it didn't take much to shock my sensibilities before we left, but now I'll eat just about anything. I remember in a market in Tunisia, the thing that shocked me the most easily was there was a cage full of birds, like little birds. I don't know what kind of bird they were, but I want to say the cage was like 2 foot by 2 foot by 2 foot, and there were like 200 birds in it. And the sound that was coming out of the cage, I can't even describe. It was like gnashing of claws against just this horrible, horrible, like, sound. And I thought, what was going on with it? And then there was a guy sitting next to the box, and every couple of seconds he'd reach in and he'd grab one of the birds and hold it real tight, and he had a knife in his hand and he was slitting their throats one by one and selling them. It was really intense. We got a couple of pictures of it.
Yeah.
So I think that was probably my like shocking market moment.
Now, when we were traveling, you tried all sorts of foods, too.
Oh, yeah.
What was probably the most, in terms of comparing to the average American's diet, what was the most exotic thing that you tried?
At a small little place in a tiny town in the mountains of Laos, we had deep-fried rat and dog stew. I have to admit that the dog stew was actually pretty good. It actually was. And the rat is just as awful as you might imagine it. It was just terrible. And another kind of exotic thing, I guess you could say, is that our first day in Laos, we met up with some friends of ours who are tangentially related to us via a couple of things. And they had met some people in Laos before us, and they were in the city that we had ridden to. And they were throwing a big party, and so we went out to join them for this Laotian party. And they were serving traditional Laotian food, which I guess is a lot of goat-related stuff.
Well, it was a special sort of a festival. They had slaughtered a goat, and then they had various dishes involving, you know, various pieces of goat. So there was goat skin salad with raw goat skin. There was curdled goat blood salad. There was, like your average stewed goat, which was quite nice. And there was a couple other things I can't remember, but.
And there was one thing that, not everyone was drinking, but they were sort of passing around shots of. There's a really, really strong alcohol. I think it's probably similar to Everclear. Don't quote me on that though, but they called it Lau Lau. And they would mix it with all kinds of stuff. And they had some like pink Lau Lau that they were passing around and telling everyone to drink. And they were saying that, if you're a man, it'll give you stronger and it'll make you grow hair on your chest. And if you're a woman, it'll make you more beautiful. And, it turned out that it was goat's blood plus alcohol.
It was goat blood Lau Lau.
And, so yeah. We all tried it. It was, I don't know, I guess it tasted how you would imagine it, just really, really alcoholy and kind of coppery.
Okay, yeah. I can't imagine it being particularly wonderful. I don't expect it to. It's one of the things that are listed on your must-do at home when we get the homestead pulling things.
Definitely not.
No.
No. Yeah, you know, I've eaten goat many times. My family used to frequently roast a goat for family get-togethers, and I always thought it was good.
Yeah.
People who haven't eaten it have given me some funny looks, and several people even associated it with devil worshipping, and I had to assure them that, no, it didn't have anything to do. I don't know how the association was there.
Mm-hmm.
But markets in Arizona, typically, it's not unusual to see goat meat or mutton for sale, even full skin mutton heads, sheep heads, which I think are kind of gross. I can't imagine dining on it, but, you know, I know a lot of people did. They would bake them and eat them whole. So, you know, and when you're traveling like this and you're meeting friends and, you know, here and there, and you're making new friends along the way, you know, what were some moments that you would say might be kind of turning points, things that kind of changed or shaped how you were doing your journey?
We stayed with a couple in France. There's another great bicycle touring website out there called the Traveling 2 or traveling2.com, and Warm Showers is a website you can use to find people to stay with specifically for cycle touring, and then there's it's like couch surfing if you've ever heard of that. Anyhow, the over at Traveling 2 recommended that we stay with some friends of theirs in the south of France, and I think it was maybe 2 months into our trip, maybe a little longer than that, but so we stayed with them, and they were cycle tourists as well, and it was the first time that we had gone to someone's house and stayed with them through a online site where you can call and see if they, or you can send an email and see if you want to stay with them, and we were talking with them about our journal, and is Ingrid and Eve were their names, and Ingrid told us that she thought it was really important to write about the bad things that we had experienced. She said that it sounded like our trip had been going really well, and she wanted to hear about the hard things we had experienced. She wanted to hear about the things that we didn't like.
No. She said that we were doing a good job because we did write about it, and to write about it more. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
She was saying that many people don't write about the hard stuff, and they only write about the really good stuff, or they only write about. You know, how it all worked out in the end, but they don't talk about how much it sucked to pedal up that hill in the heat, and they don't talk about the really, really hard things.
About how you wanted to go home that one time, or...
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was
well,
kind of...
Well, I know that when you're looking at these blogs, you know, it's kind of right, because they leave out the part where you're like, you know, you're tired, you know, and I can imagine what it's like. You're cold, you're tired, it's raining for the third day in a row. You've been riding for what seems like forever, fresh food. So now you're down to, like, 2 packages of crushed ramen noodles. And, you know, you just want to go home.
Yep.
Painted a pretty
By leaving that out, people get this impression that nothing goes wrong.
Lots of stuff.
Or they're the only ones that things go wrong for.
Yeah.
And that's not true. I mean, any of us, as we're going through life's journeys, have sat there. I don't care what kind of thing you're doing, whether it's, you know, a role like a parent or a spouse or whatever. There are moments when you're sitting there and you're thinking, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't like this very much. You know, I want to go home. You know, or the equivalent thereof. I want to just quit.
Yeah.
And you can't. I mean, you really can't. You know, most of life's really fascinating journeys. You can't just quit. I mean, quitting isn't an option. You can't go back in time and so forth and so on. So when people, you know, talk about their lives and leave out those moments where this sucks, I really hate it, I don't like it, I don't want to do it, you know, it kind of creates a really wrong picture.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That actually, towards the beginning of our trip, that's actually something that we had to go through as a couple, because when things were really hard, I would say they were really hard, and Tyler would be really stoic, and he thought that it would be helping me if he would just be really stoic and quiet and just muscle through.
Yeah, I thought that, you know, in the early portions of the trip that basically I couldn't admit that anything was difficult, because otherwise, like, then everyone would just be like, what the hell have we done? Why are we doing this? You can't handle it. And so Tara would be having a hard time, and she'd complain about it, or she'd say, you know, I don't like this. And I would always just be like, I'm fine. Everything's fine. And even if I was feeling, you know, the same, because I wanted to be the strong, you know, supportive, whatever. And I don't think it wasn't until maybe a month and a half into our trip. I think we were in France. Actually, a couple of more months than that. But anyway, we were in France, and I think the first time I said, like, I want to go home, or I admitted that it was hard for me, too. And it was like a revelation that Tara wanted to hear that. And it seems so silly in retrospect now, but just to be able to say it and get it out and then just leave it behind you was really helpful for me and us, I guess, to be honest with each other. So that was a hard, hard-fought lesson.
Now, you know, when you guys left on your trip, you hadn't been a couple all that long, had you?
No.
We'd been dating for about...
Would you say that going on the trip has shaped your relationship?
Oh, absolutely.
Hugely, yes.
Absolutely, yeah. When Tyler sent me that text message, we had been dating long distance for about 2 months. And then we started planning the trip. So most of our relationship revolved around the trip. And at about 6 months, I moved to Minnesota to live with him. And then 6 months after that, we moved in with his mom so we could save money. And then another 6 months after that, we left. So that's how it went. It was all pretty fast.
That's good. The entire first portion, then, of your relationship was shaped either by actually doing the trip or planning for the trip. When you got home, did you find that you had readjustments to do in terms of your relationship?
No, I don't think so, no.
I wouldn't say in terms of our relationship, but I would say in terms of everything else. Because we had just been on this 2-year trip together, so we were really solid. But coming home to everything else was really jarring. Just American culture in general, and we came home to some family strife, and just coming home was really hard, and it was surprisingly hard. We sort of thought it would be this wonderful, easy thing to just come back, but actually when you come back and you're completely different people than who you were when you left,
it can be pretty alienating.
Yeah. It was a little alienating and a really rocky landing, so. Not in terms
having
of, it was a
moved
couple,
away
but.
From an area, I was still very young, and then moved back to the same area, and you meet your same old friends, and everybody expects you to be the exact same person.
Yep.
But while you've been gone, you've been doing a lot of growing and changing, and you are not the same person that left. That made it hard for the readjustment for me, because I wasn't what people thought I was. and they couldn't accept the changes. Did you find that was somewhat true when you came back as well?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it depended on the person. Some people we found we clicked with right away, and a lot of people who we had been close to before, we just found we'd sort of drifted apart from, and or we had completely different interests and motivations in life, and so some of the people that we met on the trip or through the trip are now some of our closer friends because they know us as we are now, so, or we've had experiences together on the trip that were really intense and binding, so.
Yeah, you know, when you think about it, 2 years, that's as long as a short hitch in the Army and whatnot. And, you know, probably just as dramatic in terms of how it changes a person. So when you were when you started off on your trip, did you realize that when you came home you were going to be different people?
Not in the way No. We just had really, I had a really idealized idea of what it meant to, you know, ride a bike around the world. It just sounded like a great adventure. I didn't picture it as the, you know, giant personal growth quest that it turned out to be. Like, no, I don't think so.
Well, besides the drudgery of actually pedaling a bike every day, over and over and over again, and uphills and downhills, and in the rain and in the sun, what was probably the more difficult part?
Besides the cycling, what was the difficult part?
Yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of people would say, well, it'd be the holidays and birthdays being away from home.
For me, I think I had a lot of difficulty. When we left on the trip, I was a pretty type A person, very liking, just really, really wanting to have control of every situation. We started out in England where I could speak the language, or we could both speak the language, so that was great. And then we took the ferry to France, and so it was a gradual easing into a process where we were kind of just out there with an inability to communicate. Tara speaks French fluently, so we left a place where we could both speak the language, and then said Tara could speak the language, and I was really, really, really relying on her to, you know, make sure everything was okay, and that's really the first time in my life that I'd done that since I was a little kid, and so that was really good for me. And then after France, we went to Italy, where neither of us spoke the language, and just the experience of learning how to navigate without being able to communicate, or learning how to navigate with only being able to, you know, communicate a very small amount. It was really challenging, but also really invigorating and rewarding, I guess. Like, we would, before each country, we would learn, you know, basic phrases like hello and goodbye and can I have this and how do you say this and I don't speak this. And it was really a fun part of the adventure, but it was also really difficult. So I'd say that the language barrier was definitely part of the difficulty, but
I think for me some of the difficulties lie in the fact that before we left on the trip I wasn't outdoorsy, I didn't go camping, and so there was a huge learning curve there. I hated being wet and cold, and that's basically what our first 2 months were like, was being wet and cold constantly.
You should say why.
Because we were in England and it rained constantly and it was April and it was freezing cold. So for me, a lot of it was physical stuff, like just toughening up to weather, toughening up to living outside all the time or most of the time. Another really difficult thing, or something that if you're in the right mindset is really fun and adventurous, and in a different mindset, it's really disheartening and difficult, and that is just accepting the fact that you have control over basically nothing, or there's very little that you actually have control over. You might find a nice hotel, you might not. You might find a really wonderful campsite, or you might be sleeping in a garbage dump. And you might find a great local restaurant, or be scrounging around trying to find ramen. And, you know, there's just so little that you can pin down and say, for sure, I know that at the end of this day, my evening will end like this. And eventually, I mean, sometimes it's really fun, and sometimes it's really difficult. And my sort of saving grace during the difficult times was I always knew that we would sleep in our tent. Eventually, I just had to accept the fact we would find a place to sleep, we would sleep in our tent, and I would get to sleep in our own sleeping bag. And so that was sort of like the one thing that I could count on. And everything in between was up in the air.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can, you know, kind of imagine that. We're right now living in a travel trailer, and mm-hmm. that means nothing's convenient.
Yeah.
Everything's very small. We have 3 dogs and 2 cats. everything's small. There's no room for anything. You can't find anything. You know, and we're trying to figure out where to put this, where to put that, and how this work, and how can I scale this down? Do I really need this?
Mm-hmm.
That's, and I'm finding that as I have weeded and weeded and weeded, I need and need and need less.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. that is something that comes along the way. But, folks, the first half of the Dawn of Shades has come to an end, and it's time for a break. While we're gone, check out our website, www.exogenynetwork.com, and let me know what you think. We will be back in just a few minutes with more from our guests, Tara and Tyler.
Are you the guys on the beach who hate everything? Is this some sort of hip music that I...
Welcome back to Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and tonight we're having a great conversation with Tyler Kellen and Tara Allen. Tara and Tyler, I know that your next project, you've already started with the first steps of that, and that is creating a self-sufficient homestead in Vermont. Now, for a lot of people, the idea of going from a big project of a two-year world bicycle tour to a homestead in Vermont is like an impossible change. It's like going from being a movie star to being Amish or something. So what made you decide that was what you wanted to do? You know, where is the progression from the bicycle tour to the homestead?
Well, I think throughout this whole process, the bicycle tour was initially Tyler's thing. It was his idea. He had to sort of convince me to do it, and eventually it became our project, very strongly our project. But at the beginning, it was his project. But for as long as I can remember, I've wanted to have a self-sufficient homestead, just like Tasha Tudor, who lived in Vermont, who was an author and an illustrator, and she was one of my heroes growing up. And so the self-sufficient homestead was, to begin with, my idea that he was just sort of coming along with. But eventually it became our project. And I think that being on a bicycle tour actually flows seamlessly into having a self-sufficient homestead, because you see, when you're out in the world, you see so many different ways of living, and you're used to living with very little, and so many different farms and villages that you pass have all different ways of living, and most of them are a lot more sustainable than what we found at home. And so I think this was a way of continuing that and bringing that home, and living a life in a way that was fulfilling to us, and I think this is the way to do it. So, what were you going to say?
Yeah, I would agree entirely. I mean, our conception of what a home is before we left and after we came back has changed vastly. I mean, there are so many different ways that you can create a home, and nowadays, or I don't know, what you would consider normal in America just seems foreign to us now and strange. So, firstly, the idea of building something ourselves is absolutely something that we want to do. We're going to have to do it if we want to, you know, build something that's really unconventional. And so yeah, it does kind of flow, I guess, seamlessly from one to the other for us anyway.
Yeah.
Although a lot of people told us before we left, when we would ask questions of long-term travelers, they would talk about how, you know, when you go on a trip like this, you'll be forever changed and you won't be able to settle down anywhere. You'll want to travel forever. You'll be, you know, you'll never be able to settle down. We definitely didn't experience that, but that's definitely an aspect of it that a lot of people experience, where if you're gone for more than a certain amount of time, then you're nomadic for life. That's just how it is. But we didn't experience that part.
Yeah. So, we'll always travel, though.
Yeah.
And go on adventures and things, but.
Also, just moving around and traveling and constantly going from one place to the other, the idea of having a safe, secure, settled home base that's ours is really appealing. So, you know, there's some desire there, too.
And one more thing is that on our trip, I guess one of the main things that I fell in love with about our trip was the fact that we were camping all the time and we were outside all the time, and especially in Eastern Europe, we found some just beautiful free camps where we would carve our own little, we had our own little patch of wilderness all to ourselves, and I think we really fell in love with that idea of having our own land and being able to hide in the trees as much as we want. So, that's a wrap.
I can remember most of my life I lived in an extremely rural section of Arizona, and then moved from there to New Orleans, where my apartment complex had more people than the little village I had lived in. And then we had a town, you know, 6-8 miles from where I lived. But it was still a huge culture adjustment. I can remember that probably the noise bothered me the most, because you could never escape the noise.
Yeah.
Now, I no longer live in New Orleans. I now live in Mississippi, and it's much quieter where I live, but it's still far noisier than Arizona was, where I'll have to admit that. But when you were traveling, did you find that noise levels had effects on you, could it change your moods and whatnot even?
Absolutely, yes. People often ask us what our favorite country was or what our least favorite country was, and it's a really silly question, but Vietnam, we had a really difficult time in, and it was solely because of traffic noise. Well, not solely because of traffic noise, but in large part because of traffic noise. It was really difficult when you're riding a bicycle. You generally, you know, you get into a groove where you're kind of in the zone and you're not really thinking a whole lot, or you are thinking, or you're just watching the scenery go by. But in Vietnam, there's just the traffic constantly honking, and people are passing in, you know, one-lane roads and just overtaking in totally unsafe ways, and the traffic is just insane and loud and in your face. And we found it really, really difficult to get into any kind of a groove in that environment, and it was really demoralizing and really difficult. And I think we found that more and more as we went through the trip, also that we would actively avoid cities wherever possible, because it was just so much harder once you're in a city to, and suddenly you have to be navigating, and yeah, it was the traffic noise and the sounds and the surroundings definitely had a huge, huge impact on how we felt, and we hugely gravitated towards being in rural areas the longer we were on the road. So, yeah, I agree entirely. And that's certainly something
when you came back, did you find that you had more trouble coping with being in suburban and urban situations?
Yes. Yeah. It was really depressing, and it just felt so dead. And when it started to get to be wintertime and we had to close the windows, it's just wrong to not hear any nature sounds. And we eventually started camping outside in the winter. No longer doing it, but we did camp outside for a while just so that we could hear some sort of nature, because everything felt so sterile and closed and unnatural.
Did that shape where you chose to start looking for your potential homestead sites?
I mean, we started out with a map of the U.S., and we didn't really have any kind of concrete idea as to where it was that we wanted to end up. It was really kind of a daunting project, actually. We crossed off the whole southern half of the United States, though, no offense. We don't like heat very much, so that was an easy decision. But as to where we wanted to end up, we didn't really know until we saw it. Like, when we came back from the trip, we flew into California. We stayed with Tara's brother in Oakland. And we drove home from there, and we paid really close attention. We'd gotten really good at observing after 2 years of traveling, and so we paid really close attention as we traveled across the U.S. back to the Midwest about how we felt about each of the places that we went through and as feel and what we thought about how they looked, and do we think maybe we could live here. And we didn't run into much that we felt really compelled by on the West Coast. And then a few months after we returned, some friends of ours were going on vacation, and they lived in Maine, and they needed someone to watch their house. So we drove out to Maine, and on the way to Maine, we drove through Vermont, and again, on the way, we paid really close attention as we traveled about the places that we went through and how we felt about them and what they were like. And I'll never forget, we took a ferry into Vermont for, do you remember the name of the lake?
Lake Champlain?
Maybe Lake Champlain, but yeah. Okay. So we took a ferry into Vermont, and I'll never forget driving off the ferry in Vermont, and immediately there was just this sense of, it was like a weight was lifted off your chest. It was open and rolling and rural.
And quiet.
And quiet, and it felt, it reminded me of Romania, and it took us a while to realize it, but there aren't any billboards in Vermont. We're like, what's different? Why does it look so different? But they don't, there's no billboards anywhere in Vermont, and that was, I mean, it seems like a silly reason to pick a place to live, but it had a huge impact on us, too, and yep. We just really, really fell in love with Vermont, and it was fast, and it was obvious, and we knew that, you know, it was going to be New England, it was going to be Vermont, and from there, we just started, you know, searching, trying to figure out where would the best place be in Vermont. It got a lot easier when we narrowed it down to a couple of states,
yep.
So...
So I know that you have found your location and you've bought it, and you're currently working to get it paid for. When do you anticipate actually moving there and starting on your project?
We had hoped to do it this spring, but it's looking like financially it probably won't work out, so we'll probably head out next spring.
We'll probably go there before we actually move there. Because there's plenty of things that need to get done on the land, and we could at least get started even if we don't move out there. So
trees that will need to be cleared. It's the property's 10 acres. It's pretty much covered in maple trees. And so, yeah, we'll probably go there and maybe, not maybe, we'll go there and we'll cut down some trees and start a wood pile and get some wood curing and
eventually build a cabin.
Clear the drive, and there's a lot of stuff that we'll need to do to prepare, so... We'll certainly be visiting, but I'm really focused right now on just making sure I want to have the land paid for before we go, and we're about 35% done paying for it, I think, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to finish it by the end of the year. So.
Yeah, it's a big project when you go to buying land. You know, and the whole homesteading project is, it's a big one. A lot of people don't realize that, you know, they think it's all old McDonald's farm and like Tasha Tudor's pictures, and they don't realize that putting wood is really hard work, and cutting down trees is really hard and dangerous work. And when you're milking that cow, they will go poo and they'll kick you. chickens are really, really gross, and they do disgusting things like eat each other. And you know, there's a lot to homesteading besides growing tomatoes.
That's very true.
Yeah.
It's a different kind of glamorous.
Yeah,
you know, and I've milked cows and I've milked goats and I've tended to horses and sheep and all sorts of animals, and I've raised many, many gardens and grown many, many trees and cut down more than a few myself, split lots of wood, and it's a lot of hard work, and in planning and building your own from the ground up, that's an incredible amount of work too. So what is the very first things on your project?
The very first things on our to-do list?
Yeah.
Well, there's a tree down in the drive. You can't drive up to the house, so we'll have to clear that out. There's no house. Yeah, sorry. Up to the home-ish site area. We want to do off-grid eventually, but initially we're not sure financially if we'll be able to do it, so probably one of the first projects will be getting some kind of an agricultural electric pole put up so we have some kind of electricity. There's already a well on the land, which is great, but that's one of our primary needs for electricity to run the well. And then we're considering building a platform and setting up a canvas tent on it, maybe it's 200 square foot canvas tent with a wood stove inside, and that's probably where we'll stay for the first year. And then we're planning on building, we think, right now it could change, we're thinking of a straw bale house, which is basically you construct the walls out of straw bale and put plaster on the outside of them to grossly simplify it. It has a really incredible insulation value. It's very cheap, obviously. And so that's what we're thinking we'll construct our house out of. We're also really interested in cob, but we would do that for buildings or some things that don't need to be insulated and heated and things like that, because it gets obviously pretty chilly for a long time in Vermont.
But in terms of other first steps, I think we just made a list the other day, actually. I'm trying to think of what's on the list. We'll need a truck, and we'll need a chainsaw, lots of tools. I don't know. We were actually just sort of feeling a little overwhelmed by all of it, so we took our own advice and made a list. So we just got to work through things one by one. I feel like we're kind of in the stage that we were before our trip, where it seemed really glamorous and really easy to talk about, and I just know that it's going to be really hard. Probably about 70% of the time it'll be really hard, and I might not like it very much, but that 30% of the time is going to be the best 30% that I ever had. So,
yeah, so we're starting
I have to admit, the first time that it's got freezing rain, everything's covered in ice, it's miserable out, and you got to go milk a cow, feed the chickens. It's probably not going to be very much fun. But, you know, it's like a lot of other things. Habit makes it become easier. You're used to always doing it every day. So it's not as big of a deal. Mm-hmm. It's no fun to be trying to carry a bale of hay while you're doing the slip and slide routine on ice. I've done it a few times. Even though where I live didn't get snow like Vermont does, because our snow didn't stick around for all winter. It would just be here and then it would go away in a few days. It still would, you know, things would freeze, things would get ice coated. And it could be kind of a tough, miserable experience. And, you know, a lot of people talk about living off grid and they don't think about what it can be like. I've lived off-grid, where the grid has never gone, even. And, you know, you can have your propane refrigerator, your propane stove, and your propane lights, and life goes on, because we didn't have solar pitter, we didn't have a generator, we just didn't have any electricity. And, you know, the water was pumped by a windmill, and gravity flow tank delivered it to the house. The bathroom was an outhouse, which most areas don't allow anymore. But life was pretty primitive, pretty difficult, and in the summer it was really hot. I'll admit, I really missed electricity then. You know, and so when you think about being off-grid, you know, you're not talking about a primitive lifestyle. You're really talking about creating your own power supply with solar or wind panels, right?
Exactly, yeah. We had a solar survey done on the pool. We bought it, and it looks like we'll be pretty good. So that'll cover us for, you know, spring and summer. But obviously, you know, late fall and winter, there's not going to be much sun no matter where you put the solar panels. So we're looking at a bunch of other options in terms of how to generate power. There's a really interesting guy in Detroit that's making Stirling engines, which are a different form. So an internal combustion engine, all the explosion and all the heat and stuff happens inside the engine, but on a Stirling engine, you heat the outside of it, and it works on a heat difference and pushes a really large piston out and in, and they use them on, they use them for big manufacturing plants and stuff like that, but there's nobody that's making them on a small scale, and they're really, really, really well suited to generating electricity, and so there's this guy that's working on making these Stirling engines to generate steady state 1 kilowatt power. And so we're hoping to use one of those for power in the winter. You know, either running off excess heat from our wood stove or, you know, just keeping it fired when we need it or whatever. But we'll have a battery array and we'll keep it charged with our solar and our Stirling engine and probably heat our water with, just a big black tank soaking up the sun in the spring and summer and, excess heat from the wood stove in the winter, and so we're just kind of putting all the things together, but we're definitely not in any way experts at all. I mean, it's sort of like when we left on the trip and we cycled off into Scotland, it was the first time we'd ever ridden our bicycles fully loaded. Like, we're doing all the research and we're doing all the planning, but certainly we're going to get out there and find out it's probably a lot different than we had imagined it would be, but we're doing our best to prepare for it, so...
Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you talked about that one of the first things that you did was had a solar survey done, what exactly is a solar survey?
So someone comes out to the land with a device that's called a solar pathfinder. Usually that's how they do it anyway. It's a really interesting piece of kit. It's basically a circular plastic device with a plastic dome on top of it, and the way that it reflects the light, you can look down into it and you can see your surroundings reflected in the top of it. And inside, under the glass dome, there's a piece of like grid paper that shows a big arc and times and a grid. And you look at where the shadows are being cast in the reflection. And based on the arc of it, you can see what kind of sunlight you're going to have year round. And you draw a line across where the shadow line is in the reflection, and then you can kind of get a really good idea of what sunlight's available at the location you're at.
So it would show, for example, you know, the shadows from the trees would show, oh, at this certain date, you're going to be in shade after 4 p.m. After 4 p.m., you're not going to have any more sunlight. And it just depends on the location and the trees and everything. So
yeah, so if you Google solar pathfinder, we'll explain it a lot better than we have, but it's a really interesting little device, and so we feel pretty confident about the location in terms of being able to power via solar. So,
you know, when you were looking to choose your location, what kinds of features were you looking for?
Once we got into Vermont, once we narrowed it down to being in Vermont, we had several things in mind. We knew we wanted some water on the land, either some sort of stream, river, pond, something. We knew we wanted water. We knew we wanted there to be lots of trees. I didn't want to be in the mountains. I wanted to be near the mountains because I love the mountains, but I'm from Illinois and I just don't want to live in the mountains. So... something close by, beautiful, natural areas, but not necessarily in the mountains. And what else, Tyler?
Well, a lot of it was, I mean, we had ideas about what we wanted, but it was so hard to tell. I mean, we'd look online at properties, and you don't know. You don't know until you go out there and you look at it. And so we trusted our gut, I guess. I mean, we went to 24 properties probably in the course of our search, and I would say that all but 2 or 3 of them were immediate no's.
Yeah, even if they looked on the internet, like, beautiful, even if they had all of the features we wanted, even if they had water and trees and you know, a beautiful stone wall meandering through the forest, whatever. And we would get there, and sure, all those things would be there, but it would just feel wrong. Like, it just wouldn't feel like home. And it wouldn't be as we had imagined it, and it just wouldn't be quite right. So,
mm-hmm.
so some of the things that we looked out for were actual physical things, and other things were more of a gut feeling. What feels like home? Where can I imagine coming home to? Where can I imagine living?
A lot also about just the surrounding area. Like, there were a couple of properties that we liked a little bit, but as we drove up to them, we just didn't like the area that they were in. And I don't know, it wasn't an easy way to quantify exactly what it was that made us decide, you know, this is the one, but the one we kept coming back to, and it was the one that felt right, and I don't know, we just knew.
Yeah, I think a good...
Well, you know, a lot of people search for property by school district or by its proximity to other amenities, be it a golf course or shopping or whatever, but those weren't the kinds of things that you guys used.
No, not at all.
Definitely not.
Definitely not the golf courses. Definitely not the school districts, although that wouldn't have been bad.
We were pretty keen on the idea of being near several farms so that we could get, you know, food from local farms. But you know, outside of that, we weren't really too concerned a whole lot with, like, sort of your traditional location concerns, like, is there a supermarket? Is there a mall? Is there a movie theater? We didn't care about that stuff.
But on the other hand, one of the things we do like about the place we're at is that while we're on the property, like we're out in the middle of nowhere, in reality, we are about 15 miles from a town with a hospital and a grocery store and, you know, those basic things. We're about 4 hours from New York City and 4 hours from Montreal. And so, you know, there are things to do should we get bored of the woods, but that wasn't definitely our primary concern.
Now, do you anticipate getting bored?
No.
Never.
No. We have too many going on, too many things happening, and if, you know, I wouldn't say because we got bored, but we always have more trips planned and more ideas of things we want to do. We want to hike the Appalachian Trail and go on more bike tours, and so there's always things we want to do. I don't think we'll get bored.
I listen to people talk about being bored, and I'm like, yeah, I haven't had time to be bored in, like, decades. Maybe it was my mother's training when she learned at an early age, never say you're bored because she gives you something to do that you didn't want. She learned to entertain yourself. I don't know. But boredom isn't something that it happens to me very often. I mean, there's been a few occasions, like if I've been in a hospital room, like confined to a bed, that, yeah, I was bored because I'm not much into TV, not much else to do in a hospital. So, yeah, maybe I was bored then. I didn't dwell on it a whole lot, I guess, because I don't remember for sure. But, yeah, boredom I can see is not happening for you two very often.
More like a lack, more like feeling like we don't have enough time to accomplish all that we want.
Yeah.
Not like on a day-to-day sense, but just like existentially, like we're not going to be here very long.
A lifetime is not a very long time.
No, I can tell you, having already finished the first half century of my life, it's an amazingly fast journey.
Yeah.
Don't waste a day, because you'll regret it. And believe me, you know, things work much better when you're under 30 than they do when you're over 50. You know, that's the only thing I find about age is I forget how old I am. Until I go to do something, and I'm like, why can't I do that? Aww. You know, because you do. Your body, over the years, you've injured it, and you've abused it, and you've pushed it too hard, and you go to do things, and it's like, oh, that hurts.
Oh, no.
That hurts. Yeah, so that's one thing is keep in mind is tomorrow may never happen, but today is going to be gone all too quick.
Yeah.
So, don't always value today. It's a wonderful day. Now, along the way of planning your homestead, I'm sure you're establishing some goals, because I already know from reading your website before, Yeah, you guys are really, really efficient at planning, as well as adjusting to when things don't work out exactly the way the plan thought they were gonna. What kinds of goals are you establishing for your homestead itself?
Well, I mean, we need to get some of the land cleared. We need to start our wood piles so we can have warmth in the wintertime. And really, we need to learn more about alternative building. We need to get prepping with straw bale and with cob, and then we just need to do it. It's kind of scary, but we just need to do it. And then in terms of our actual homestead, I don't feel the need to be 100% self-sufficient, and that I won't go buy, you know, a gallon of milk down the road from the local farmer. Some things I really want on our homestead and some things I don't. Like, I don't feel the need to have a cow. I would love to have some goats. I would love to have some chickens. I already can a lot of food, so we'd be doing a lot of gardening and a lot of canning, and that sort of thing.
We're going to keep bees,
make honey. We have some future projects maybe for having some sort of a little store, like an online store, where I can sell homemade soap and homemade cheese. I want to learn how to make cheese. There's actually an artisan cheese school in Vermont, the only one in the country. So I would probably go to that. And basically, we just love making things. And more, we're trying to steer away from the computers, make things. And we'll be selling soap and honey and homemade maple syrup and cheese and all kinds of things. So, and I also, I have a degree in sculpture, and I've done a lot of ceramics, and so I'll be doing pottery as well and sort of getting that whole thing going. So lots of projects.
A lot of things centered around creating and making things ourselves.
Now I have to admit, when I'm looking at cows, okay, I'm familiar with, you know, the usual Holstein that most people associate with being a milk cow. And they're very large, and they make a lot of milk, which is fine if you're running a dairy, but it's not so fine if you're a couple living on a homestead. And recently I encountered miniature cows.
Really?
These are Jersey cows that are small. They're not but about a third the size of a regular cow. And apparently these were the original Jersey cows before they were bred to be much bigger, better milk producing. And they're supposed to be very, very docile, because I was like, I told Greg the other day, my husband, I said, I want one of those cows. Because they look really, really sweet, you know, and they're dog-sized.
Wow.
They're not much bigger than a dog. I have a big dog. Yeah, they are. You have to do a search for miniature cows.
You definitely will.
Because
yeah.
They really, really do exist. There's miniature donkeys, there's miniature horses, there's also miniature cows, and they're all roughly that. I know you've seen miniature horses. Everybody's seen miniature horses.
Yeah.
They're roughly that Shetland pony size, you know. So they're not intimidating. If you've ever been kicked by a cow, you have a healthy respect for their feet. And, you know, if you've ever had one charge after you, because I grew up in a rural portion of along the Iowa-Minnesota border, accurate as a kid, running like the Dickens for all the ball, and barely tumbling, literally tumbling over the tailgate of a feed wagon to escape him before he hit the wagon. I could feel his breathing on my back as I was running, is how close I came. I have a big respect for bulls. And I really never was enthusiastic about the idea of owning my own cow. But these miniature cows are quite appealing, I have to say.
Yeah, that does sound appealing. I had no idea.
Yeah, because, you know, these big cows produce something like 3 to 5 gallons of milk a day. Very few families can consume or use 3 to 5 gallons of milk a day. And these smaller cows are considered more appropriate for homesteads.
Hmm.
And produce a much smaller amount of milk, eat a lot less, need a lot less acreage, and so forth and so on. So I found them absolutely adorable. Jersey cows are pretty anyhow. And these small ones are much less scary in terms of size.
Cool.
Yeah. So that was something I told Greg. I mean, I just see me adding a miniature cow to our menagerie in the travel trailer, right? No, I don't think so, but yeah. All things come to an end, and when we're no longer living here, then get my miniature cow yet. So no prospects of becoming pig farmers or making your own hams, huh?
Oh, no, I definitely want to do that. I don't know that we'll do it, you know, forever, but I really am keen to give it a go, at least for a few seasons, and see what we think about it. But, yeah, that's definitely something I want to do. So
yeah, it would be interesting to cure your own meat and go through the whole smoking process. I've read about it. I've done small-scale things like, you know, hot smoking fish and poultry, but not as far as curing meat goes. And, you know, it's something that nothing smells better than a well-cured ham, anyhow, the old-fashioned kind.
I have it in my mind that I want to try to make a Parma ham. After our experience of all the delicious, delicious meats in Italy, I'm certainly keen to give that a go.
A lot of our goals for our homestead involve food, and not just food for sustaining life, but food because we love food and want to experience as much of it as possible in various ways. And so,
yeah, well, food is an exciting way. It's so integral to cultures as well.
Mm-hmm.
Most of mankind's big events are also associated with particular foods.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're an American or whether you're from some other country, there are certain foods that your culture will associate with food. You know, be it wedding cake, although I have to admit, Greg and I just got married last fall, and our wedding cake was as non-traditional as our wedding was, because we had a hippie beach wedding, and complete with tie-dye t-shirts and rainbow veil and bandanas, the whole bit. And we had a lot of fun with it. And the groom's cake was tie-dyed, is what it looked like. The batter was actually colored like that. There's actually pictures. If anybody's curious, there's pictures on the website still. They'll still be up for a few weeks. We're in the process of moving out, so some things will be changing with it. And we had a lot of fun. We had friends and family there. We had a lot of fun with it. And the base of our wedding cake was a herb and zucchini cheesecake, which was completely a surprise to everybody but my daughter, who did the cake. And yeah, it was very different and quite a big surprise. But we had a lot of fun with the whole wedding. It was a lot of fun.
Okay.
So it's, you know, we do associate food with activities. Who can go to New Orleans and not have king cake or gumbo or shrimp etouffee or at least some of the wonderful food that's there? Mississippi doesn't seem to have as many real specialties, at least down here along the coast. Most of ours are pretty similar to what you find in Mobile or New Orleans. A little less spicy, a little less adventurous maybe, but it's pretty similar. And then the whole South foods. The Midwest has its, the Southeast, our Southwest has all its foods. West Coast, you know, each region, I mean, Vermont and maple syrup are almost synonyms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I think of Vermont, I think of maple syrup. Yeah. That's about all I know about Vermont, to be honest. because, there again, it's not a place I've ever visited. So, with all these maple trees, obviously you're going to have to try making maple syrup yourself, too. Have you done that before?
I have not done it before. My grandfather used to do it a little bit in the backyard. He just had a couple maple trees, and he would do it and, you know, just make a little bit of syrup every year. But I can't wait to make maple syrup. I think that's a blast. It'll be really fun. And almost our whole property is covered in maple trees, so we certainly have the resources for it. So I'm really excited about that. So that should be good.
Now, you were talking that water was one of the features that you wanted on your property. What kind of water did your property come with?
We have a small pond on our property. It's a spring-fed pond, and it needs a little tender loving care. We need to get some moving. We need to get some oxygen moving in there and stuff. It's got a little bit of pond scum on it, but it's really nice, and it's got a, what's it called?
A deck.
It's got a little deck. So eventually we should be able to go swimming and ice skating and all that stuff. So.
It's kind of strange, actually, because there's really nothing on the property except for a well, and then you go walking up to the pond, and there's like a pretty nice little deck that's been built onto it.
Yep.
No idea why.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. There's nobody did anything else with the property. Why did they put a well on a deck?
I think they ran out of money. Again? I think they then ran out of money, but...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we were just very fortunate. I think it was a good find.
I think so,
very
too.
Very fortunate.
And it sounds like it's something that you're really, really looking forward to. So... You know, you're wanting to try all these new things on your farm. Have you made plans to go to workshops and whatnot, say, on non-traditional building methods?
We haven't made any formal plans to do it. We've looked into some of the classes. I'm more of the school of learning by experience rather than paying someone to teach you. I think that probably it would be a really good experience for us, but I'm all right to wing it and make mistakes, too. So I think, I mean, we're definitely reading books. I don't know that we'll attend any classes, though.
Yeah. We do sort of wing it. I think it works pretty well for us. We do a lot of research, get really organized, and then wing it, usually throw out the plan and learn as we go along. So it works out for us. But we have some friends in Tennessee, and they're going to be building a straw bale structure, like a small straw bale garage this summer. So I think we'll probably head down there and build that with them and just get some firsthand. None of us know really what we're doing except from reading in books. So I think it'll be a really good experience for all of us to try that.
Sounds like an excellent game plan is some practical experience with people that you already know to build a smaller structure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like a fun project for sure. Now, as far as friends and people in Vermont, have you made friends there yet?
We have, actually. We've met quite a few people through our website and also through traveling in Vermont. We have some friends in Maine. We have some people that we met in Thailand, actually, who are from Vermont. And we get a lot of people from our website saying, oh, we're from Vermont, you know, welcome. We are really excited that you're going to be there. Some people from Quebec. And each time that we go visit Vermont, we've met a couple more people, too, some really wonderful, really knowledgeable people. One woman who did our solar survey is really like a great person to have on our Going Slowly team, I guess. She knows a lot about sustainable building, and some other friends that we met just while visiting, just really sweet people. He's an electrician, so he should be able to, you know, lend us a hand with some of the electrical stuff, and just a lot of really neat, pull yourself up by your bootstraps kind of people up in Vermont. So.
Uh-huh.
That sounds interesting.
Now, you know, having read your journal, and I know you're working on the bicycle touring cookbook, have you made any plans to turn your journal into a book or to write a book about your creation of the homestead?
Originally I was starting to write a book about our travels, but it was so daunting and so overwhelming that I eventually started doing the cookbook, which I was much more interested in at the time. But now that I'm, at least the end is in sight for the cookbook, which I'm really excited about, I am now starting how I want to do the book and all that. So I will be starting on that. at some point. I'm not sure how much I'll actually be writing new stuff, because in a way I feel like we wrote every day for 2 years. There's not all that much else to say. I mean, we were really pretty detailed in our journals. So it might be more like a coffee table book with best of stories and photos and things like that. So I'll be working on. And in order to do the cookbook, I bought a book and learned Adobe InDesign, so I'm laying out the whole thing. So it's been quite a learning process so far, like a huge learning curve for me. There were a lot of things I did not know how to do, and I'm just going through them one by one and figuring them out. So the cookbook's sort of like my experiment book, and then once it's completed and out in the world, then I'll work on the next one with a few more tools in my tool belt. So
go out to Vermont and start on the homesteading project. We're intending to journal every day like we did on the trip. I'm sure we'll have just as many experiences to write about on 10 acres as we did in, you know, three continents. But, yeah, so there's a lot more writing in our future for sure.
Yeah. At the moment, we're sort of not doing as much with our journal because I've been working on the cookbook and Tyler's been working to pay off our land. So our journal's not quite as exciting as it used to be, but we're still posting occasionally, and we just had some friends over and built an igloo, and we spent the night in our igloo, and so we'll post about that eventually, and all kinds of little things, but once we get out into the land, we'll be posting all the time, just like we did on our trip.
Well, on that note, we have already run out of time. Carrie, you're going to have to send in some recipes for the exogenic cookbook, too. But, folks, the program has gone all too quickly, and I hope that it has given everyone plenty of food for thought, as well as more illumination for your own personal journey towards truth. Join us again next week as we return for another fascinating conversation that's sure to also have plenty of food for thought. You're listening to The Dawn of Shades, and I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.
American girls, American guys, we'll always stand.